to me, when I look at this, having run security orgs for so many decades, my immediate thought is, how do we keep the long tail of businesses from panicking over this, taking their eye off of what they were supposed to be doing, you know, like risk management, and running to the other side of the boat and panicking about supply chain now?
The Adversarial Podcast. Why you gotta be so adversarial?
Adversarial.
It's time to get adversarial.
Welcome back to the Adversarial Podcast. It's good to see you guys as always, and looking forward to jumping right in here. Mario, I have to, in the sake of saying good morning here, I got to talk about the shirt you're wearing. What is this thing? Where'd you get this?
Yes.
Where have you worn it?
This was given to me by a colleague. At Snowflake, and this was a t-shirt he made for me because I was going to retire. And so he basically say, you know, talks about all my problems, but none of the security problems are mine anymore because I'm going to be retired.
Oh, that's awesome. I got to read it out loud for our audio listeners. It says, I got 99 problems, but vuln management, third-party breaches, SOC 2, FedRAMP high, and on and on, ain't one. That's fantastic. Hey, before I see what Sunil's up to, I have to say, when I quit, they made me a Lexan little nameplate, like people might have had on their desk, and it said, it had the company logo, and it said, Jerry Perullo, quitter. Sunil, what have you been up to?
Well, I was supposed to be in Tel Aviv next week, so recent events have derailed that.
I'm curious, with this whole geopolitical storm that we're under, in a situation like that, is it you saying, yeah, guys, I'm not going to be there next week because things are crazy? And they're like, come on, man, this is just every day. Or are they saying, yeah, this is too crazy, we can't bring people in?
Well, my litmus test is if a whole bunch of European and U.S. airlines don't want to fly in, then that's probably a good signal to maybe hold
on. So it didn't have to be said. It was basically like an unspoken agreement.
Yeah.
On that note, let's jump right in. So the hot topic, I think, right now is that cyber nexus of the pagers, of the backdoored, so to speak, weaponized pagers, and then later walkie-talkies, you know, exploding in Hezbollah. Lots of implications on this, the obvious one being supply chain. What are your immediate reactions? Obviously, we all need to be thinking about the different geopolitical environment today, but does this change the threat landscape for many companies?
I'm sure it causes people to say, wow, at a much larger level, we would say, could this happen to us, right? That's the general question that we ask, and whether at the government level or at the corporate level. And at the corporate level, I think it's a risk management sort of calibration here. What's the likelihood that someone's going to plant bombs in our actual phones and cause them to trigger? It's going to be pretty low. But that said, I think the real effect here was a psychological effect around, just imagine if you had 1,000 of the top Fortune, you know, Fortune 1000 CEOs' phones all blow up at the same time. Okay. There's the psychological effect of that is massive. And I think that's what is causing most of the consternation, certainly in Lebanon. But just imagining that in our space as well, it just creates a whole different way of thinking about, it changes your risk management tolerance, you know, your risk tolerance for some of these things.
Yeah, I mean, the way I look at it, you know, to your point, I used to say when it came to running security for the stock exchange that our top concern shouldn't have been data disclosure and that kind of thing, but rather Guy Fawkes mask showing up on all the trading terminals, right, live on CNBC, for the exact reason you just put it really well, of what that would do to confidence in the public markets in that case.
To me, what I learned from this was I went back into my paranoid self again, right, our CISO paranoid selves here, and I started thinking not necessarily as in a hardware, because I'm not a hardware guy, I'm a software guy, so I instinctively went to software and thinking about this problem. And if I could think about like pagers, I mean, first of all, I got to give kudos to the Israeli intelligence. They're amazing. That's a team that knows, takes their time and figures out some of these weaknesses in the whole supply chain for their threat, who they're going to target. I think of a, how many of us are using pagers anymore? And I would argue a lot of us are not using pagers, at least not in the States. Okay. So, right. Maybe doctors, maybe I've seen doctors have pagers, still using pagers. So if I were to use that and look for its kind of counterpart in software, I'm thinking of a software package, open source package, or even a commercial package that has not been used for a long time. It hasn't been updated, but people still use it. Right? Maybe because of their industry, they haven't migrated from that software. And so I think of these repos as not being supported a lot, and it could be ripe for an attacker to target those. Now, you got to know who your target is going to be in the end, right? So you don't want to just spray it everywhere. But if you're doing your due diligence and understanding your victims, your potential victim, your target, what their business are, you will find within the software industry, some of these small mom and pop shops, I'm not trying to blame them, but I'm just saying that's what you would target if I were them, or one of these repos that hasn't been supported for a long time, and then put a malware in it.
Yeah, and one of the things I think is there's some interesting practical, I don't know if it's that practical, but the security principles that we can apply here. One is... from an attacker space, and here I'm flipping the notion of an attacker for a moment, but the Israelis have greatly limited the channels through which Hezbollah can operate. That is why they ended up using pagers and walkie-talkies, right? They knew that pretty much everything else would get them killed. So now you've narrowed that path. You've narrowed the channel upon which you can communicate. And of course, once you've done that, you can now understand where the weak points are in the remaining channels that you have. I think we've seen this supply chain. We've seen this supply chain attack type of approach happen before. And I think another really good example for those who haven't who may know about it is captured in DarkWire. So if you're not familiar with the book DarkWire. It talks about how the FBI ended up running a encrypted cell phone business. And one of the ways that they tried to get more and more people to use this encrypted cell phone business is by shutting down or by trying to take down some of the other competing ones.
Wait, so, and this was a covert cell phone service?
Yes, it was. The cell phone service was called Anom. Okay. A-N-O-M. And it's all captured in this book called DarkWire. But the point is, it was another, sort of chef's kiss type of operation here. And if you think about that, that was also a supply chain attack. Okay? And what's really kind of cool about the DarkWire book is it goes into incredible detail into how it was pulled off and how they, again, narrowed the set of options that the attackers that the criminals could use, so that you can then ensure that if you did a supply chain attack, you got them exactly where you wanted them.
Good analysis of it. But to me, when I look at this, having run security orgs for so many decades, my immediate thought is, how do we keep the long tail of businesses from panicking over this, taking their eye off of what they were supposed to be doing? Like risk management and running to the other side of the boat and panicking about supply chain now, right? And the way I look at this is you don't want to be Hezbollah, right? And I don't just mean that in the other 4 million ways it could be taken, but you don't want to have a nation state adversary willing to invest 9 figures in a decades long, or I don't know how long this operation went, but in 5 to 10 years probably easily, to create a totally fake supplier and all that. Fortunately, right now, ransomware actors are not willing to devote this kind of resource, and that's probably the number one threat that most businesses are worried about. So I don't think this justifies a panic over that. And I also, you guys may remember, I don't know if you had to wrestle with this like I did, but in 2018, Bloomberg came out with this story about Chinese chip implant backdoors into motherboards. Mm-hmm. And, into Supermicro motherboards. That's exactly one. And I ended up writing this whole refutation on the thing, which got pretty interesting. And I talked to the reporter, too. I remember him ringing me on my cell phone, standing there talking with him about it. And I wasn't arguing with him about it. I was, you know, hearing about his sources and all. And by the way, it was a whole lot of, well, I can't tell you the sources, but highly respected and that kind of thing. And nothing added up about that story to me. So I would hate for this current story to add any credence to that one of like, yeah, see, we told you people are backdooring things. On the contrary, I think this just shows you the kind of motivation and capability and resources you would have to be able to pull this off. And by the way, we had a hyper-specific target in this story, right? It wasn't, I think that Bloomberg once was like Apple and Google and half the world supposedly were targeted in this fashion. So to me, it's a very interesting, when as a CISO, when you go home and watch the news and you're very interested in what's going on in the world, but not necessarily a call for action at almost any company.
But I think, Jerry, I look everything from an economics perspective. If I think of a salesperson, two different cultures of sales, one is just going to be, I'm only going to land one business a year, and I'm going to do my homework. I'm going to learn who these folks are, who the buyers are, and just really, because one of these deals can make you as a salesperson, you know, a lot of money, right? And then there's the other type of sales folks who are like, I got to just hit the numbers. It's a commodity.
Spray and
pray. It's not, right, that's right. And so it's, I think of them as different. When you were talking about ransomware and hitting everybody, I think of those as being opportunities. I got to spray and see somebody who hits me, right? Let's see. And it's a numbers game. Right. While I would argue what the Israeli government is doing, and some of these, you know, government agencies, they're much more focused. They're going to land once and once only.
Yeah, you know, I lectured on this just a couple weeks ago, and I do every semester, right? So there's this module in my course where I talk about threats and threat objectives, and the whole point of it is, you know, you got to taxonomize the world into these different threats because each one has different TTPs. And once you figure out which threat you're on the receiving end of, then you can focus on the TTPs. And it used to be, so I have sabotage as one and extortion as a different one. And they used to be very different. But some of the TTPs are becoming very similar, actually. But what I always love to say and has held is that in extortion, you have fungible targets. Right, if you're after one and then they have enough defenses that it's making it a pain for you, you just shift over to the next target. If you're targeting the the Hong Kong exchange and you can't get in there, you go after a retailer. It doesn't even matter. You just have to extortion. And the main differentiator with sabotage is a non-fungible target. Right, you can't just swap out some other agency for Hezbollah and do this to them.
Which raises the cost. You were saying a lot of the TTPs are similar. Let's go back and understand why that's the case. And the traditional way to look at that is that kill chain approach. The kill chain gives you the supply chain mapping of an attack, okay? And maybe going back to even something that you keep hammering upon is, banning ransomware payments. That's creating, there's a supply chain element to how ransomware payments are being made. And part of what you've been articulating in the past is let's consider how do we narrow the potential possibilities that a ransomware attacker can get paid. And then when you've narrowed that to a sufficient point, you can do something more interesting because you know exactly how to target that specific point of weakness. And this whole notion of supply chain attacks and just understanding the graph or mapping of the supply chain attacks is actually something that we should be doing for ourselves, because what we're wanting to do is to narrow those attack paths that an attacker can use against us as well. And wherever those paths are extremely narrow would be places where we would want to have extraordinarily good monitoring, extraordinarily good instrumentation. We want the attacker to play on our playground where we have control over what's going on.
But Sunil, don't encourage Jerry, all right? This whole thing about his personal jihad of his to ban ransomware. Don't encourage him, all right?
Such a right.
That's
move.
A pipe dream.
Yeah.
Well, I think part of the reason why we disagree why banning ransomware may not be the right path is because it, who knows? Well, my view is it's not really narrowing that attack path as much as maybe other measures might.
Yeah, well, and it's funny, like, so the taxonomy I referenced to has extortion because I taxonomize by the objective, what people are trying to do. And I always say people aren't trying to ransomware people, they're trying to extort them. And ransomware was a convenient way to do that. And when that dried up because of Mario, I'll explain what I mean by that in a minute, but when ransomware dried up because of Mario, they pivoted to data extortion, right? And what I meant by dry up because of Mario is the West Coast architecture, right, where there wasn't a bunch of PCs in a LAN that you could lateral movement and Guy Fawkes mask them anymore. So then they started pulling data out of SaaS. But the objective was unchanged. But if you, and I think that's correct within the cyber context, but if you step back a level even more, the objective was getting money. And yep. Extortion was how it manifests in cyber. So if you choke that off, I will posit, if you choke off the flow of money through extortion by blocking ransomware payments, those individuals and those ransomware gangs will still be in desperate pursuit of money. I'm not going to say they'll go out and get better jobs or anything like that. I get it. And they will go back to other criminal activity that may be less lucrative. But it's almost like sanctions, right? Like when we sanction proper SWIFT payments to North Korea, they still want money. But overall, they're getting less of it. And I think that would happen.
So let me then offer another counter to that. What was interesting about the Hezbollah pager attack, as well as the Anom attack that was Anom service that the FBI ran, was at the point that we as defenders wanted to take action, it was in our control to do that at a wide scale and disable a significant part of the attacker infrastructure all at once. And the question I would have with banning ransomware payments is, That's not a, it's like a little bit at a time sort of disablement, if you will. What's really fascinating about both the Anom and the Hezbollah one is just, we pulled a switch and whammo, okay,
yeah,
all at once. There's a ton of criminals who are in hiding because they were caught up in that, and they had to scurry and find, they had to create their own new lives because they had to, you know, they were, they're so much details in their encrypted chats. So, but the point is, if we want to pull a switch of some sort, a lever of some sort, then I think it has to have this sort of very significant impact to really, really disrupt that supply chain. If it's done one little bit at a time, it may not make much of a difference.
Yeah. Yeah, I thinking about it, like I would contend that the percentage of population that is criminal and motivated enough to become ransomware operators hasn't changed. Like if you go back 100 years, I would say there was the same percentage of people. And I guess the question is, were we in a better place back then? And was it just because those folks were not winning? They were not gainfully not employed, but acting, and they just didn't have the means, and they were poorer. And is that a state? And was that the end game here? Because if so, I think cutting off the ransom payments would work.
We saw towards the, I forget the exact time frame, but in the 2010s, credit card fraud start dropping down. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, great, we won. Only to see all other forms of cybercrime go up. And the net effect was it didn't really change. The percent, to your point, Jerry, the percentage of fraud and whatever, the overall losses kind of remained the same threshold. And actually, I think the book Darkwire talks about this as well. All sides are motivated to achieve some sort of equilibrium. Okay? And when equilibrium is lost, weird things happen. More people die because criminals do certain things that just incentivize that equilibrium to be established, or businesses lose lots of money. You know, there's all these different things that happen. But the point is that I think that there's a natural equilibrium state where everyone is generally like, all right, let's not mess with this. But each side is incentivized to put it out of equilibrium.
One of the ways we use threat intelligence where I was at before was what I wanted to understand, credentials are all, people aren't going to lose credentials sooner or later, like your social security, okay? That's why you constantly need to change your freaking password, folks, all right? Don't hard code things, all right? I don't want to pontificate here, but please don't do that. But what I like to do, it was kind of a signal. if one of the credentials from my company had been stolen and were being sold on the market, what's the price people are willing to pay? Mm-hmm. And what Sunil was talking about, you know, credit cards took a dive. Stolen credit cards, sometime in the 2010s, 2012, they started taking a dive. It was becoming much, much cheaper to buy them because they were everywhere, quite honestly. And so I think one of the things you can kind of start getting some signals potentially about the worth of your company to an attacker is the value that they pay for those stolen credentials.
Well, you know, let me ask you guys about this, because this just came up last week and you touched on it. So I had a customer ask me for advice, and they were basically saying, like, hey, we see that there's some credit cards and emails sometimes, you know, and then kind of like, what should we do? Is this worth an information campaign? Is it worth action? Is it worth the DLP controls and that sort of thing? And I thought about it a bit, and I ultimately came back, and I talked to some of my Slack buddies, so to speak, forums, and maybe some of you saw this somewhere, but I was basically asking, like, wow, is credit card theft still a thing? That was kind of my question. And my thought ultimately was, if you put in a credit card number or an email, I don't see that. If credit card theft is a thing, I don't see it being onesie-twosies. It's not picked up on the wire. That was always a myth that was used just to sell product. Nobody's ever intercepted a packet and gotten a credit card number on a TLS email, and there's no non-TLS email. So, yeah, it sits in an inbox when you email a form where you put in your credit card number. It sits in the email of somebody at Hyatt or whatever asked for you. I, if you're an adversary, it's not worth getting one credit card number at a time. It's always bulk. So I ultimately said, like, hey, let's pick our battles. This isn't one of them. And I bet you guys too, security professionals, have sent in a credit card number via an email or an attachment at some point in the last 5 years.
Never. Yeah. No.
Well, that's why you don't have a house or a car or anything, and you're just sitting up there. So,
well, I mean, let's
it a thing? Is credit card theft a thing? And
You're framing the problem in two different angles. So let's understand the two angles first. The first angle is, as a consumer, as a user of a credit card, do I really care about sending credit card numbers out?
Mm-hmm.
The answer is no. Why? Because in the U.S., I'm not liable for any of those losses. Yeah. So sure, here's my credit card number.
It's perfect risk transfer.
I don't know if I would call it perfect.
Well, you don't have to file a claim and have reputational damage and have your yes. premiums increase. None of that crap. It's
don't
perfect cyber insurance.
Don't use your debit card, folks. Never use your debit card still.
Ah, good point.
Unfortunately, those who don't have the financial means have to use a debit card. Unfortunately,
right.
They're also the ones who get hit the worst in these cases, too. It's unfortunate in that regard. But from the user standpoint, there's no risk. Right. So sure, here's my credit card number. On the receiving end, the question is that one of their standard processes to receive credit card numbers via email or whatever, you know, non-traditional means that you might have? And of course, if there's a company that does that as a systematic part of how they run business, then yes, because now you do have a large number of credit cards in one particular place or in one particular format that could easily allow us to, you know, to mine that and grab that at scale. Hopefully nobody is doing that, and hopefully anybody who is doing that will get hit over their head with PCI and all that kind of stuff, right? But that said, that I think we have to make sure we have the right perspective of who's threatened and where the attacker is going to focus.
But separately, are people grabbing credit card numbers in mass nowadays? Even with, I mean, all I could think is imagining. You know, sending people lookalike pages and forcing them to key them in. Like, is that big business these days, or have the threat actors moved to other areas?
For what it's worth, I think Max Butler, he's out of prison now. I think Max Butler, for those who don't know, he was profiled in a book called Kingpin, and at one point in time, he controlled the entire credit card.
He got out? Wow,
yeah,
I'm getting old. I remember reading that book. It was a great book. Great book. Kingpin, great book.
But anyway, that's it. So with that example, Max, not that he's going to return to crime or anything, but if he were to try to start a business again in credit card, you know, in the carding market, would he be successful? And I think I would argue, no, there's other more interesting things to go steal and sell.
This sounds like Dr. Evil. $1 million He's been away for 10 years or frozen. Comes back. Hey, I got a great idea. We're gonna steal credit cards from individuals through their email.
Yeah, exactly. Anachronism. All right. So, hey, there's next thing to chat about here. So, one of us, I forget who it was, brought up this idea, this incident of this GitHub scanner campaign that's leveraging GitHub's natural communication method to send what are, in essence, I don't know if fish is the right word, misleading emails that are credible, right? They're leveraging infrastructure. Is this novel? What do you see here that's interesting?
Well, there's novelty in that. So there's cleverness in co-opting a well-established, well-understood, well-known service that gets, of course, through every possible filter because it's GitHub, right? It's not novel in that it's another example of an open relay type of situation or open relay type of architecture, and I think we as builders then have to just be mindful of, you know, what are the circumstances under which we can be co-opted, our own services can be co-opted for this purpose. Because if you think about it, there is a lot of these types of services that can be co-opted, and it's just a matter of the attacker spending time and focusing on those.
And just to clarify for anybody who's not able to see the screen, the attack path here was basically comments on a repo. Is that right? You submit comments, so now all of a sudden the repo owner gets an email that's actually legit, passes through everything. But it says security vulnerability detected in your repo and has a link that's actually bogus. Yeah.
It looks like GitHub, but it's not.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. You know, this form of attack, there's so many different angles on this stuff. So you guys are going to be patient with me because I'm going to go on my rant today, right?
Let's go.
So this GitHub email that they receive reminds me, it's a very similar attack to what they did with PayPal. There was a PayPal campaign when some, I think either customers, quote unquote customers, said they wanted their credit. You received an email somehow from these folks, and it was the email origin was PayPal, but the contact, the link was a PayPal something else, and people fell for it. And it's actually very successful for that PayPal campaign. So these folks are doing something very similar to what Sunil was highlighting, I believe. The thing that really is worrisome to me is that these folks install info stealers, right? So there was an executable installed it, and it was supposed to be an info stealer. And the minute I start thinking GitHub, info stealers, my blood pressure goes up, okay, folks? Because naturally, I hate to say this, our developers are hard coding secrets often. Maybe not in production, maybe they'll do it in dev environment. I don't know. But there's always hard coding something going on. Mm-hmm. And this is not too far-fetched to say, huh, this info stealer is getting installed on your machine. You, the developer, aren't aware of that. You enter a hard-coded secret for an application you're developing, or maybe a Terraform script, or goodness, maybe a database in the cloud that you have. And now these info stealer guys start, you know, collecting all this information and they go sell it. Maybe they're not the attackers, they actually go sell. So Jerry, to me, this looks like the new credit cards of yesterday, campaigns from yesterday, right? Because now you have some of these companies that are paying some of these data ransomwares, where they steal your data. They're not encrypting your data. They just steal your data and says, I'm holding your data. And some of these companies are paying $20, $30, $40 million. And once you see that, you're going to get a bunch of other attackers trying to replicate that attack. And I see this just as a very smart but very scary campaign.
Yeah. And I think to that point, like, and tying that back to the credit card question I had a minute ago, I think what we're learning is, you know, if you can steal some keys, you could sell them to the attack chain, to the access broker world, all of that, probably get paid reliably and not have to just get a mule to buy a bunch of payment cards at Kroger and, you know, and a bunch of gift cards or something like that. So maybe that's why the attackers have shifted over to more of this.
Going back to the earlier conversation around how do you limit the attack paths for an attacker, it would seem to me like one of the things that I would love to make easier is to have domain reputation be a service that people can call and decorate URLs like this. So again, this sort of function of relaying emails is a widely repeated design pattern in many, you know, applications that are out there, right? Okay, and of course these emails that go out may have links. Well, is there a way we can make that kind of service where we can decorate the link with some sort of reputation score be just a standard practice?
Yeah, it's a scary area though when you get into violating message integrity, and that's and I'm not saying that to refute you right away. I'm saying that because I've gone down that path a lot and thought about that.
I'm not necessarily saying that message. I think that could be before the message is actually sent out. We can have that decorated before it goes out. So it's just a call. It's just some sort of service that's called that says, anytime there's a URL, we just decorate it with some. We do a quick domain reputation check, and that's it.
Yeah.
Okay.
My red team. I had a previous red. These guys were just violent and just always humbled me. Every freaking morning, I would be humbled by the red team that we had. And what they would do is, and it's no surprise, but you go buy a DNS, you buy a DNS name, and you hold on to it. You hold on to it for months. Maybe you even create a fake website. It's real easy to go generate traffic, folks. Make it look legit, okay? And I hate to say this, a lot of what Sunil is talking about, which is totally accurate, these systems would not work. That filter, you would absolutely not, you know. But you're right, Sunil. But again, now we're talking about...
We're adding burden to the attacker.
That's exactly it. So now, to Jerry's point, what am I going to get? What's the extortion? What's the money ball? I always think about what is the money ball that I'm going to get out of this activity as an attacker.
Moving on, changing topics a little bit here. So I was listening to some other podcasts, and one of the things that came up in the last, I don't know, just a couple of weeks, apparently the head of Airbnb had some talk where he talked about founder mode, and I don't even know how it became a controversy because it's not that exciting. But what he was basically saying was that there's some, maybe I'm paraphrasing this poorly, but that's how I took it, that that it's okay to have some more micromanagement and being prescriptive and hands-on as a founder in early stages, and that you kind of have to, and that if you just take the typical, like, Harvard Business School guidance on being a CEO about hiring strong people and letting them run, that you can't do that in the earliest stages, like to get past escape velocity. And this phrase of founder mode came out of it, and then it seems like everybody is really angrily, vehemently agreeing over and over. It's just one of those things people want to make into a thing that's not. But the reason it caught my attention was that, and in particular it was like founder versus manager mode. I've thought about this a lot over my career, and I noticed, so, you know, I was at a really big public company, but the majority of the people I worked with were founders. Right, founders of that company, even a couple decades in, they were still around. And then I witnessed as it kind of molted and it went into a new generation of leadership. And I remember thinking about it and saying, like, if any of us, both at the company or in a broader environment, any of us as leaders of companies, if we were made the CEO tomorrow of J.P. Morgan, J.P. Diamond says, hey, you know, Mario's the guy. I'm out.
Oh, that's a terrible decision, but okay.
Let's go with it. Let's go.
Sunil, I'll go with Sunil, but go ahead.
Well, I think it's only going to reinforce my point. Or let's say it was Jerry, right? What am I, when I go in there, the only thing I'm thinking about the Tuesday morning is not screwing it up. You know, I'm not at all thinking about how to go 10x or 100x on market cap. All I'm thinking is the headlines are going to happen if I screw this organization up. And so if somebody busts into my office the next morning and says, hey, Mr. Perullo, you know, normally Jamie would have approved these things. I guess it's you now. We're going to do a major release and change everything in the platforms to you know, enhance some things. It's going to be great. Can you click here to approve? I'm not approving. I'm just... Hold on. Whoa. Let's slow down. Let's get some more opinions in here. I don't even know what I'm doing. And to me, it's not founder versus manager. It's founder versus custodian. Mm-hmm. Right? And there's some really good custodians, and we've seen a lot of the startups that we know and love make it to a certain point where they have to have a custodian implanted there to lead the company instead. Right? They get to a certain size, and the founder's just making different decisions. And I think the mentality difference, and this applies a lot to cybersecurity, is the difference between, you're talking about a risk manager either way, and it's the difference between assessing the quality of a risk manager by the risks that they avoid versus those that they take. And I think that founder mode, if anything, it's just you have to take the right risks. And custodian mode is you have to avoid the right risk.
I think that as, you know, I went through, I'll be the first, I'm not a founder, but I go at early stages, right? So maybe I'm not necessarily the founder of that company, but I'll join early on in some most startups that I've joined. And that's where I gravitate. That's who I am. And I had such a blessing, such a blessed story with my previous employer, Snowflake, where, you know, went from 50 employees to where when I left, I think it was 7,500. And I just got to tell you, I personally, I don't get excited about being a manager or the managerial side. I suck at it, quite honestly. Yeah, I just suck. I get bored, just lose it. So one thing that, you know, there's a book called Principles. It's called Principles. I'll often quote it. Yeah, Ray Dalio. And whatever you think about Ray Dalio, folks, I get it, yada, yada, yada. But there are some nuggets of truth in there. And one of them is, first, know who you are. Be true to yourself. Know what you gravitate towards to, what you like and what you don't like. And try to find if you have the ability to hire folks who can complement your weaknesses, right? And so I look for my managers that I hire were folks who could, handle parts that I just didn't enjoy, quite honestly. You know, yeah, just Sunil.
Well, so let me, I'm a framework guy, so let me offer some ways to think about this in a framework standpoint. One view of founder mode versus manager mode is somebody who operates in wartime versus peacetime. Mm-hmm. And you can't sustain a wartime mode all the time. You have to have some form of peace. You need to have a peacetime mode where people can relax and create new things and whatever else it is. But during wartime mode, you are, as a founder, you're going to be very specific in terms of we need to take that hill, or have these very strategic goals that you articulate as a founder and say, this is what we need the whole team to do. And I don't have too much time right now to hear everyone's opinion. I may take a few, but look, we need to get going and accomplish some objectives. So that's one view. Let me give you another model that is interesting. It's from Ron Westrum. And he has what he calls the organizational typologies. There's three organizational typologies. And the organizational typologies are pathological, bureaucratic, and generative. Generative, okay. Now, many founders are also known to be pathological, okay. which is kind of interesting in some respects. So founder mode is a pathological, it could be seen as a pathological mode. Generative is what most people desire for their company to be. Information is shared, and the messengers are welcomed. There's a lot of bridging between different teams. Wonderful, unicorns and rainbows and all that kind of stuff, which we definitely want to have as a company. And when we're in peacetime, that's exactly what you want to be. But when you're in wartime, you want to be very, again, pathological in nature. Mm. Now, that bureaucratic piece, loss aversion is a real thing. And when you have much to lose, you're going to tend to be bureaucratic in nature and say, hey, wait, do we really want to do this thing? Because I'm pretty happy with where I am. And so I'm just happy to have things slow down and have a lot of built-in processes or have all these processes be enforced. So I found different ways to apply that model in ways that are interesting too. So think about in a business is not one just generative or just bureaucratic or just pathological. All three are represented in a business. So usually the money-making side is the generative side.
Yeah.
Audit and compliance is the bureaucratic side. So guess who's the pathological side?
Security?
Yes, that's right.
The security. Red team. you know, that's a really... So Neil, I mean, both you and Jerry have startups, and eventually as your company grows, as it will, I'm betting on it, you're going to start hiring sales folks. And so as you're growing a business in the sales world, there's a concepts of hunters and farmers. And hunters are the folks who just want to go out there and break into a new company and get that business, get in there. It's a really land and expand is what you'll hear sometimes being told. But landing is that hunter. Expanding are those more farmers. They're going to now, they got a moat there, and now they're going to grow it out. I would argue, both of you guys in the startups mode, I don't think you want farmers. I think you want hunters. Yeah. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I'll give you another paradigm, and this one's from, Simon Wardley, I think it is. So he talks about pioneers, settlers, and town planners. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's a third category, I think, beyond the farmers part. So pioneers, of course, are the hunters. And for startups, that's exactly what we need. We need people who are going to be pioneering and drive new types of engagement. And then, yeah, eventually you need people who are going to settle and farm and make sure that you cultivate these things and continue to sustain it at some level. But at the larger scales, you need somebody who's going to be a town planner who can say, wait, are we doing these sales operations even in the right way? Let's reconstruct and rethink about the infrastructure that's needed to grow this beyond these small little tiny family farms.
Yeah. Yeah, Mario, it's a really good point. I mean, I guess, and I think it's fun when we talk on here about the startup ecosystem generally, whether it's ours or others. So I might be, you know, going way off piste here, but I'll bring it back, I believe. I think, you know, as a founder, and in particular as an old founder, right? I mean, I think Sunil and I are old founders, without a doubt.
Oh, you guys are kids. What are you talking about, man?
Well, I hope not, because I'm about to explain why we're so great about it.
Experience, yes. Right.
Well, you know, that plays right into my point, which is, as an experienced founder, I like to think that I have invested a lot of time, decades even, in building some skills that, as a result, I need help with different things, and hopefully less things than, you know, a younger founder. But I recognize that I need to, and I used to when I was in my garage, right, I used to have on the whiteboard there this big cloud, and I talked about like outside help and all the different areas that a startup could use outside help with, ranging from corporate actions and formations to creating a stock option plan to raising money to sales and go to market and product and all of this. And I went across around that whole cloud, and I tried to say, like, where am I special? Where have I those decades of experience? And a ton of them I nailed, which was great. And I said, okay, I've got like 80% of the pie here. But to me, it was really important to figure out the ones where I'm not any better than, you know, somebody coming right out of school. And I mean, maybe I'm a little bit better on sales because I've been around revenue generating organizations and P&L, so you have to touch it in some way. But I haven't had to go out there and beat the bushes in any way that, you know, I could really claim success on. So to your point of like, hey, that's coming, you know, what are you going to do? Get help.
Yeah.
and will that help manifest as like the hunter side versus the farmer side? I think the big thing there, and I've seen this a lot when working with investors and VCs who are coaching startups, you know, I'm always thinking of a million things that they could do and a million directions they could run. And a lot of times the investors are really coaching, like, finish your plate, like have a specific win here. Yeah, you could go in a bunch of verticals. You start on this vertical, show traction before you even move on. And so likewise, when you talk about hunters versus expanding, land and expand and horizontal growth within accounts, I immediately go towards all of it, right? Oh, let's do it all. When we have three customers, let's start expanding those customers before we roll out number four. And I suspect that your wiser minds would say, chill out, Jerry, you know? Yes, you can expand them, but let's just worry about getting traction on the core modules and the product first before you start moving laterally. So so I'm not willing to commit an answer to you what my strategy would be, because I'm going to seek counsel before I do that. Sunil, do you feel the same way as an old founder about picking your strengths?
Oh, well.
My words, not yours, on old.
As one who's experienced, hopefully has the wisdom to know what you're good at and what you're not
good
at. And even if you know what you're good at, the general principle is you always hire people who are better than you,
mm-hmm.
including what you're good at.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, which is probably easier when you're good at something, because then you know what's BS versus what's legit. Yeah.
All this experience talk is reminding me of Jimi Hendrix's song, dude. Right? Like, oh, now man. I'm really dating myself.
That's
here.
It. That's all it took. You know, I'm going to be on a week.
Are you experienced?
Hendrix.
That's going to be my question if I'm a PC.
Have you ever been experienced? You've got your two interview questions right there. Oh, that's great. All right. Let's talk about something totally different here. I can't believe that we haven't gone through the open source, closed source debate yet. And I'll tell you, it came up. I thought we had, because I had discussed it in my class Slack, which is about 300 students. And a lot of them are experienced, to get back to Hendrix. I mean, they have 5 to 10 years. They're working right now in cyber. The online students and the in-person students run in the opposite direction. We have undergraduate students in there, too. So it's great because you got a lot of different opinions. And so the question came up of, you know, what's more secure? And I think it's worth talking about in open source versus closed source, because I think the assumptions that I have aren't universally shared. Mm. So, well, I know your answers to which is more secure. I already know both of you are going to say it depends. And then you say a bunch of stuff. Is that right, or no. Do you have an immediate answer?
Let me take a stab at this one first.
Okay, West right? Coast, CISO.
As you go through, you know, in the startup world, and you know, you'll get through the next round of funding if you're fortunate enough. And as you get closer to a potential exit strategy, whether you're going to get acquired or you're going to go public, whatever that exit strategy, a successful exit strategy.
Yeah,
one of the things that the VCs will do is they'll ask you, tell me what software you have inside your so-called application. And what they want to see is they want to see if some of those software packages that you might be using, third-party software packages in your application, whether the GPL support, GPL, did they violate GPL or not? Mm-hmm. I would argue that open source, closed source stuff is a mirage, because I venture to say, unless you're in this really like manufacturing and or you have to do some of your own operating system that you can leverage something like Android or something else for your whatever device is. Outside of that, I would argue most these closed source companies are using some form of open source. And by closing it, you're not really getting visibility. You're getting an executable, but you're not getting really visibility into what's inside there. And some of that is open source that could make you vulnerable.
Mm. So there's no such thing as closed source. I like
it. That's my point. Yeah.
So let me undermine a couple other paradigms along the way as well.
Do it.
So first is a general perspective that software is not built; it's assembled. Mm. Okay. So gets to Mario's point earlier, but let me go to I think what was the fundamental part of the question, which is if I take just a look at the software itself, open source versus closed source software, just the software itself. Which one's more secure? And there's a underlying premise or assumption that we have, which is more eyeballs make bugs shallow, right?
Mm-hmm.
What if that underlying premise is changing with the introduction of AI? What what if we now have as many eyes as we want at our disposal, and we can use that to make bugs even more shallower and keep it close sourced?
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, that's really interesting because, I mean, and look, to lay out the premise, which I think we're all assume, but you know, for the listening audience, right, my argument is that closed source software is just awful, riddled with bugs. It would not stand a day if it was open and bug bountied, but it has the advantage that no one's looking. And I'm saying that because if it's open source, people find the bugs immediately and people even fix the bugs immediately and it moves a lot faster. So I basically say open source software is attacked a lot more. It's a lot more resilient, but closed source software is just kind of living a lie with its head in sand. But maybe that's okay. Maybe that's pretty good. And Sunil, you're saying you could have the best of both worlds. You take your closed repos and you take the collective brain trust of what all the bug bountiers in the world, and not to mention the SAST and the code scanning side, but which I discount that. You don't find logic flaws with SAST. You find the coding errors and what has the venture industry done to the world when it comes to SAST and making everybody only care about code security? It's just so misguided. But anyway, but your point is, you know, you could even take the bounty side of it and the logic flaws and test closed source software for use cases that were unintended, and that sort of thing. Is it operating the way it's supposed to or not? I hadn't thought about that. There's something upsetting about it, because I feel like...
Oh, it upsets the bejesus out of me. And I don't know if I can agree with Sunil's eventuality, but it scares me. Maybe there's something there. Maybe that's why I have a disagreement with Sunil on this topic.
Yeah. I mean, I guess the point is that, God, you know, because you immediately get into, like, will the models ever be as good as the humans? Well, if they're not, they'll improve.
And again, it's about eyeballs, right? So we have... if we have more eyeballs at our disposal and different types of eyeballs from different models, you know, whatever it might be, to what degree can we say that open source is actually better from a security standpoint because we have more eyeballs? If we have parity there, okay, and actually let's talk about parity here. Then open source, of course, still have more human eyeballs, but let's suppose we now have AI eyeballs that are in the millions, okay? And we now have, I don't know, maybe 1,000 more eyeballs on the human side for open source. Is it going to be that much of a difference in terms of being able to find the bugs and security flaws?
You're in this space, Sunil. So maybe help me clarify something. I mean, you can move that from the open source software versus closed source. Can we go up and say open models, open source models versus closed source models? Are we going up there as well? Is it better to have a model that's open source that people get to see, get to test, as opposed to a closed model? Is there such a thing in that realm? And if so, is that the new frontier?
Oh, I mean, that's kind of Meta's sort of view, which is, hey, let Llama be out there for everyone to use because we'll find ways to break it faster, which is definitely true. But it also opens up a whole bunch of use cases that are now uncontrolled, right? And when it comes to AI, I think it's a different type of conversation of if at some point in time AI is seen as a potential weapons of mass destruction, what sort of obligations do we have to ensure that the open weight version of that is not disseminated?
I just think people are going to find it no matter what. The human beings are creative people.
Look, I love the way that Mario, earlier in this episode, you applied the use of metaphor, right? You were trying to take the Hezbollah pagers and metaphorically apply that to software and the enterprise. And I love doing that, right? And if we do the same thing with the open closed source debate, I'm thinking like, or in particular the AI debate, right? So I didn't even brought that up, but underpinning all this is AI going to be more of a problem for cybersecurity or more of a benefit for cybersecurity? And if I play out so I'll submit the notion that good security, and really simplify it, whether you're an enterprise or small, good security is continuous testing, really good testing, finding your flaws and fixing them. And that's about it. That there's no secure state, but it's just that if you take any given mission, any given enterprise, Honeywell, whatever it is, that if you bug bounty it, red team it to death, and you do a really good job of articulating what the issues are and you fix them every time, that you'll be in a great state, both tactically because you fix little things and thematically because you'll say, oh, I keep getting the same kind of error. Let me then improve coding, whatever it may be. So if you play that out to its ultimate degree, and I'm doing that to like imagine what it would be like if you had AI on both of these. If we can just do infinite testing, have we solved the problem? Are we or at least closer to a solution in the cybersecurity problem? And I think so. And so to Sunil's point, you know, if AI enables us to do, in essence, infinite testing, whether it's open or closed source, I think at least while cybersecurity is not done, at least it gets to the point where it's so sophisticated and edge case that it becomes, you know, where cybersecurity was 40 years ago, which means there's no more, it's not a hot topic. And I think that's okay. I mean, we're trying to win here. We're not just trying to create jobs for ourselves.
Going to the comment about who has an advantage, I think this actually kind of, to me, settles the debate. Because the people who build have the advantage over the people who are trying to undermine what we built. Because if we are building software, we have first mover advantage to understand where the flaws are, right? Mm. And if that remains closed source, then we continue to retain that advantage. As soon as we make it open source, now we lose that advantage.
Hmm. So you're saying closed source could have advantages, especially in the AI world.
This is so crazy what we're talking about, quite honestly, because this is really about human beings as well. I could argue open source is a democratic kind of government, mm-hmm. right? As much as we think they are. Sure. And I would argue that closed source is more of a authoritarian or totalitarian sure. governments, right? I believe that there's no such thing as a closed system that you can keep everything you all knowing. You understand everything, and the things that you don't know, you keep it secret so the attackers don't find it. I think that's a pipe dream, okay? Human beings will find a way to, you know, bleed some information into the open. That can be done leveraged. You'll get this false sense of security when you think you have this moat, this closed source, this on-prem, this thing that you think you're protecting mm-hmm. from the world. It's fake news.
That sounds like a West Coast CISO there.
Well, I mean, I came into this episode feeling the same way as you, Mario. And I'll still say, look, for most organizations for the next 20 years and all for the next 5 years, I still think open source is not only fine, it's okay, it's more secure in general. I think it's important to kind of do a disclaimer here that we're talking about when we leverage AI to have the ability to fully test and vet and improve closed source software to this level. So I think to the average manager who isn't super familiar with it, I think the big takeaway is it should be, wow, I didn't realize we're going to need AI to get closed source security up to snuff. And I didn't realize how bad it was, because I think it is still today and will be for decades for a lot of companies really rough out there, disgusting.
Yeah.
I mean, hey, anecdote, right? I don't think I've thrown a lot in this episode. It's always fun. That Avanti Pulse vulnerability that we had talked about recently, closed source product, right? And it was just CGI scripts from 25 years ago, right? Oh. Closed source. The minute it got opened up to the threat actor, they just had a field day with it. And I think that's what's going on in a lot of closed systems these days.
Yeah. CGI called it one day Pearl back.
Yeah, I know. And by the way, I wrote a lot of that stuff. So,
My God,
that was my last significant engineering efforts were writing Pearl CGI.
But we're more experienced now.
Yeah, exactly. Well, good. Anyway. All right. Well, thanks a lot, guys. That's about all the time that we have for this episode. But it was absolutely great as always, and I'm looking forward to the next one already.